You're listening to another top-rated radio show on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Welcome to the American Hour with your host, Commander Tom Garcia, on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Good evening, everybody. This is Commander Tom Garcia, and of course, I am assisted by my lovely co-host, Paula Lozon. How are you tonight, Paula, broadcasting live from Boston, Massachusetts?
Doing great. It's a clear 59 here in the greater Boston area, and it looks like it's going to be in the high 70s into the 80s tomorrow, right through the weekend.
Awesome. Awesome. Is it going to be sunny, or are you going to have any rain or anything like that?
Sunny and a chance of thunderstorms.
Yeah, we've been, we've just been like overcast for days and a little sun breaks out. It's really weird weather we've been having down here in Florida. Just these large, sort of groups of cells, but not even really thunderstorms. I mean, we only got one little deluge today, but it's been overcast all day. It's really weird. And it's hot and humid. I'm sitting on the patio, I had to put the ceiling fan on because my thermometer out here is telling me it's 88 degrees.
Wow, that is sweet.
And I got to tell you that I'm going to guess the humidity's up in the 60-something percent, but it feels worse. But, you know, I love it. You know, I'm wearing a tank top and shorts and sitting on the patio. You can't beat that. That's why I live here, and I'll never complain about it. It just seems the weather, the cloudiness, for the last several weeks, it's just been really odd. And then we have had some nice, clear, nice days. But anyway, we got a lot of stuff to talk about, Paula. And let me get some administrative stuff out of the way. I want to let everybody know that Nick Taxia, our most requested, most demanded, most listened to guest, ever since we've been doing the show, and it goes back to a year ago, April, the first time he came on the show, and then this past April, almost on the anniversary of his first appearance on the show, is going to start doing a weekly. And, you know how we're flexible here because of our schedules and everything else. But
right.
The goal is a weekly special commentary. And if anybody knows Nick, it can be anything from one of his stand-up comedy routines. He's a comedian that does a lot of work in the D.C., Baltimore, and he goes out even beyond there to other states, et cetera. He's a really funny guy. He's got a satirical website called Da Progressive. I love that site. And he does some great satirical stories that are just, you know, completely fictional, but they're based on just the stupidity of some of our politics and just things going on in life in the world. And then, of course, he's a really sharp political mind. He's worked on numerous campaigns as a consultant, as a campaign manager, and on. So he knows the world of politics. He lives right there in D.C. And so he may give us a very serious commentary on a serious subject. So we never know what it's going to be, and that's going to be the fun part about this. So he'll be with us each week at the bottom of the hour, and after his segment, we'll talk with him a little bit about that and maybe a few other things, and then we'll let him go. The goal is not to eat up his time, but just get, you know, a taste and a flavor of what he's working on, what's going on, and add a little spice to the show, which he always does. And as I said, our most listened to and requested and demanded guest is going to be on a frequent basis. Now, it's a little bit sort of like, I hate to compare us, because there's, you know, but it's sort of like when Bill O'Reilly has a Dennis Miller on. And Dennis was hilarious last night. Oh, my gosh. It kind of comes and goes, but, oh, we were laughing. We were just laughing our butts off last night listening to Dennis Miller talk about some stuff on the O'Reilly Show. I mean, that's about the only reason I watch the O'Reilly Show is to, you know, listen to Dennis Miller when O'Reilly has him come on. So that's kind of what we're doing. We're a little copycatting here. But that's okay because we've got somebody who is just as good as Dennis Miller, I think. And we'll be fun as we go forward. Now, we've got some good guests coming up. It's on the website. I don't tend to put a lot of future stuff on Facebook because, you know, then you lose what's going on today and tomorrow and anything else. And, you know, but the website, if you go to, it's really simple. I'm going to make it really, really simple because people sometimes get lost, can't figure it out. Just go to TomGarcia.com. It's that simple. Go to TomGarcia.com. It'll cycle you over to the real website, but That's the easiest way to do it. Go to TomGarcia.com, and you'll see what we've got going today, as well as sponsors and all kinds of other links. But we've got on the 21st, Dave Weldon, former congressman, seven-term congressman, coming on the show to talk about his Senate bid for the Florida Senate race that's up here. Bill Nelson, what a, I got to say it, Paula, just a turd of a senator. I mean, he's just a waste of space and time. He does nothing for the state and does nothing for anybody. He flip-flops on this and that. He just doesn't. For a guy that's been around as long as he has, he just doesn't do anything, get anything done. He's not a leader. He's a follower. And then if it turns out like voting for Obamacare didn't go over so good, then he, you know, shifts and tries to get away from that and talk about other things. And he's just, you know, really a useless senator. We've got to get rid of him. So that's the seat that Dave Weldon's running for. And then, of course, on the 28th, we've got none other than Sandy Adams, District 24 Congresswoman, who is in her first term in Congress, and she's got a big fight coming up because as we've reshuffled the districts around, she's now going up against a longtime incumbent who's now running for the same new district. It's not new in that, you know, there wasn't a district there before. You know how the redistricting goes. It's just a matter of we've shifted everything around, and the borders have all changed. And I've just been dying to get Sandy on the show so we can find out, you know, a little bit about her first impressions going to D.C. and, you know, what it was like, you know, what some of the best information you get on any particular subject. And I use this all the time in my consulting business is talking to people that get to an organization that just got there. Now, Sandy had experience in politics because she was in the state legislature here in Florida. So it's not like she was just a newbie, doesn't know anything about politics. So she's going to have some interesting insight and information, maybe even some revelations that we're going to try and get out of her on that show, as well as what's going on, what's really going on in Washington. We got somebody coming on the show that's there, not just a candidate, but there in the thick of things. And one of the big credits that she gets, among others, is that she has not missed a single vote. And that's Sandy to a T. If anybody had said, okay, who of the new congressmen and women in Congress isn't going to miss a single vote in this session, I could have told you, I'll bet it's Sandy. And there may be some others, but hasn't missed a single vote on any committee that she's been on any bill or resolution in the U.S. Congress. So we're looking forward to having her on the 28th, 7 p.m. That's a Thursday. The 21st is Thursday as well. And let's see, what else? Oh, Joan Flowers. We're still working that. I it's one of those tough things. I put out some of her tweets today on Twitter, and I've got a guy connected with a couple different VFWs up in the Port Orange area that says he'd like to help out with a fundraiser. The problem is he's running for public office himself right now, so he's really busy. So it's just a slow, slow process. But we're still working that angle, and if anybody doesn't know about Joan Flowers, go look in our archives, April 19th, 2011, and listen to the show where we had her on the show, and we'll have her on again. We've learned it's been a whole lengthy process finding out more about her father, who is buried in an unmarked grave in Chicago and deserves to be in Arlington. And that's the goal, is to get him moved to Arlington where he belongs. So if you have any special expertise with the VA and or any interest, you can always email us from our website. Go to Facebook. It's the American Hour Radio Show. By the way, Paula, we are at over 6,700 followers on Twitter now. And the Facebook numbers are starting to ramp up because I'm actually doing something. I'm actively engaging that. I expect within the next few days we'll have over 700 or so on Facebook, and maybe even by next week up in the 2,000 range. So we'll see how that goes. But we just jumped up almost 100 likes and followers or whatever, fans, whatever you want to call it, just today alone. So we're actively working that angle for the show, something that we haven't been focused on too much other than just putting information out. A lot of people come and look at the Facebook page. It's important to click on that like button. You got to click on that like button. We've done really well with Twitter, and that was my focus in the very beginning. And, you know, in another few months we'll be at the 10,000 mark, which is great, but we need to work the other angles. So, all right.
Where we ended up tonight in the paper?
Yeah, you know, that was an online newspaper, but not only did they grab our show, they grabbed the photo of Nick and you know, yeah, that he's going to be on our show tonight, and that we're going to be talking about what the media isn't telling you, which is precisely what we're going to get into. Yeah, that's kind of cool, and that's through Twitter. I mean, that's how we get on some of these online newspapers and blogs, et cetera, is because of the stuff that we put out on our Twitter feed, which, if you're on Twitter, or you're not, get on it. I highly recommend it. But it's The American Hour. It's just simply The American Hour on Twitter. Easy to find. You can follow us, and they even put us in a list. You know, when you start getting a lot of followers, or you're following a lot of people yourself, find the people that you really like following and put them in a list. And that's real easy. Then you can go to that list, or you can have multiple lists, and then find out, you know, just what they're talking about. I get some of the best news information, inside information, just off of Twitter alone, let alone, you know, having to scour the internet news sites. I find stuff faster and more accurately on Twitter, believe it or not. So, anyway, let me talk about a couple things that are kind of in the news right now. We're going to get into our main theme tonight. It's been sort of an item for a while, and gas prices are kind of going down, but this whole concept of, can the president make a difference in gas prices, yes or no? We're going to talk about the hypocrisy of the media, and I've got a prediction to make, and this is important because I want to make sure people know this. I'm going to keep predicting this, and I'm going to be proven right. If gas prices are down in October, I'm going to be proven right, and that's just the way it is. So let me talk about a couple things here. First of all, we got liberals, even the president, talking about we can't afford to return to the Bush era of big spending. The Bush era of big spending? You got to be kidding me. First of all, let's back up. Reagan inherited a recession, and within 2 years, we were coming out of that, quickly coming out of the recession. Did he spend a lot of money to do that? No, he cut taxes. That's how we got out of a one recession. Then what happened under George Bush? We got out of a recession that he inherited. Yes, he inherited all these surpluses from Bill Clinton. The surpluses didn't come from Bill Clinton. They came from Newt Gingrich and the Republican Congress tying the hands of President Clinton. That's where they came from. So it's baloney that they came from Bill Clinton. But whatever. We'll still attribute it to Bill Clinton, you know, surpluses. But he also inherited a recession. We went immediately into a recession as soon as George Bush took office. And did he get us out of that recession in less than 2 years? Absolutely. How'd he do it? Cut taxes. This president's not willing to cut taxes. He's left the Bush era tax cuts in place, but he spent tremendously more than Bush did. So really the point I want to make on this is Obama has tripled and in some cases quadrupled down on the Bush era spending, and yet we're still hovering in a recession mode. 8.2% unemployment up, right? It's up a little bit there. But it hasn't dropped below 8% since it went above 8%. So it's really his entire presidency has been above 8%. You know, all kinds of unemployment in various states is extremely high. The dollar is, you know, gone down in value. Inflation is up. We're, by the end of his presidency, Obama's presidency, will be $6 trillion more dollars in debt. $6 trillion spent in 4 years, and yet we're still in a recession mode. Not technically in a recession, but growth, national, you know, GDP growth at 1.5, 1.9%, that's anemic. We're bordering on another recession. So he's totally failed. Two previous presidents took us out of recessions in 2 years or less, and this guy can't get us going anywhere in 4 years. Unemployment up, the value of the dollar down, and the first credit down rating in the history of our country. But it's somehow all Bush's fault. Because Bush spent too much money. Except this guy spent four times as much. I think Bush gets credit in 8 years for a total of $4 trillion in spending, and this guy's spent $6 trillion in 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
So if it didn't work for Bush, but wait, it did work for Bush. We got out of a recession. But in the end, it didn't work because it put us back in a recession. So what has this president done? He's just followed in the – this is what the media needs to be asking the president. Why is it that you followed the same game plan for excessive spending that Bush did? Why? Why'd you follow his game plan? But that's the hypocrisy of this administration. Well, we can't return to the Bush era of big spending. No, that's actually called little spending compared to you, Mr. Obama. Tax breaks for the rich. I love this. We can't continue the tax breaks for the rich. First of all, everybody got tax breaks. Well, everybody. And lower income families got bigger tax breaks than the rich. The rich got the smallest percentage of tax breaks of anybody. But if you look at what it takes to be considered rich, to qualify to be in the top 5% of income earners in the U.S., you have to have earned $154,000 or more. Now, a lot of people say, oh, that's a lot of money. But the president has said nobody earning as a family $250,000 or less will have their taxes raised. So we can't go after those people, Paula. So what does it take to be in the top 1%? About $350,000 or more. Now, if we tax everybody that makes $350,000 or more in the top 1% at 40%, so we let their tax rates expire and even raise them a little bit to 40%, that will bring in about $78 billion of extra revenue. Now, what kind of deficit is this president running? Oh, $1.3 to $1.4 trillion? $78 billion doesn't get us close. So when libtards tell you that it's the Bush tax cuts that put us in this deficit and debt problem, they're lying. It doesn't even come close. It doesn't even come close. And raising the taxes on the rich, which the majority of them in those income brackets are small businesses, will only hurt the economy. They're lying. It's a failed ideology, a failed concept of ideology. And along that same line, when Warren Buffett says his secretary pays a higher tax rate than him, first of all, it's apples and oranges. His taxes are being paid on investment. His secretary's wages are being paid on income, salary. Now, we could argue that, well, you know, people should have to pay more on investment. The whole idea for low tax rates on investment is we like people to invest. It helps the economy. It creates jobs. It grows businesses. But if it is unfair, why does not one single libtard talk about lowering the secretary's income tax to Buffett's? Why do they always talk about raising his income tax? You know what? I don't want rich people to have to pay as much income tax as me. I want to pay as little as they're paying. Well, the answer is, well, Tom, then you're just not patriotic and you're not contributing to the greater good. The greater good, a bloated federal government, the biggest it's ever been, stealing my money and wasting it. 6% of the stimulus money, 6% went to shovel-ready jobs. Where'd all the rest go?
Those jobs weren't really shovel-ready. Shovel-ready means many different things. You know that, Tom.
Yeah, and so what kind of how did it bring unemployment down? You know, $800 billion. It didn't. It went up during that period. And it slowly come down, and now it just kind of went back up a little bit. So, you know, this liberal mentality of tax, tax, tax. Here's the way it works, Paula. If we can raise the taxes on the rich a little bit higher, just a little bit higher, at some point the libtards will tell us, you know what, we're still just not bringing enough money in. You know what, we're going to have to raise it on everybody. Look, the rich, they're paying their fair share now, but the middle class isn't paying its fair share yet. So now they're going to come up on us. And then we all know the backdoor method of raising corporate taxes. Corporations don't pay taxes. Consumers pay those corporate taxes. Corporations just pass those taxes on, just like another business expense. That's the backdoor way. So not only will we get our taxes raised in the next Obama administration, but corporate taxes will go up, so we'll pay more for consumer goods and services. So we will still actually be paying more in the middle class than the rich are, just because of these tactics. And it's really, that's where the bulk of the money is, Paul. The bulk of the money is in the 99% of us. That's what they really want to go after. They're just going to lie about how they go after it. Finally, the president tried convincing David Cameron, Prime Minister of Great Britain, to release oil reserves, and he'd do the same thing. Now, they're meant there to be for an emergency. Are we in an emergency situation, a world crisis, going to war? No. The timing of this would start to drop gas prices over the summer, and then certainly by October, significantly start dropping gas prices in the short term. So do you think the president might be wanting to do that for political purposes versus what we really need? Of course. Of course. So my prediction is this. If gas prices are low enough, the people are a little bit happier, like below $3 in October, The president is going to take credit for it. The president is going to take credit for it. But before I get on to some of our sound bites, let me tell you about an article that came out by Matt Lewis in Matt Lewis in the News. This is back in March. Back in March. He said, the Washington Post poll demonstrates an interesting phenomenon. This is a poll that was taken in 2006 and then again just this year. 73% of Democrats believed that the Bush administration could reduce gas prices and that it was their fault that gas prices were high for part of early 2008. Today, only 33%. So 73% back then thought Bush was at fault and could do something about high gas prices. Today, 33% of Democrats polled believe there's nothing Obama can do about gas prices. That's a 40-point swing. Now, there were some flip-flopping by Republicans also that were polled, but only an 18% swing. So here we go. All Americans, 2006, Bush could do something about the gas prices. 62% believed he could. But now in 2012, only 50%. Democrats, 73 to 33. Republicans, 47 to 65. And independents, 66% thought Bush could do something about it. Only 53% now. So let's get into a little bit of the hypocrisy, not only of this administration, but of the complicit media. So the first thing I'm going to play is a clip. It's a couple minutes long, and it's pieced together a bunch of different news clips and speeches and other things about the media hypocrisy on gas prices, including the administration's hypocrisy on gas prices.
What do you say to people who are losing patience with gas prices at $3 a gallon?
What we are seeing is,
government
run for the oil company. Drivers are paying a heavy price for the Bush administration's failure to enact a comprehensive energy strategy. This Congress, under the Democratic leadership, is working to make up for years of inaction, taking America in a new direction that helps bring down the cost of gas.
Gas prices have more than
yeah, that worked really good, Pelosi.
Since George Bush became our president.
I understand how desperate folks are. I mean, I met a guy who couldn't go on a job search, had lost his job, couldn't go on a job search because of the high price of gas. Just couldn't fill up his tank. I met a teacher in South Dakota who loved her job as a teacher on an Indian reservation. She had to quit because the drive was too far. It was taking up too much of her paycheck. I know how bad people are hurting.
See, Obama feels the pain. He understands.
Complain about the price of gas, and you're only getting 8 miles a gallon.
Oops, not anymore.
You know, well, you may have a big family, but it's probably not that big. So, how many you have? 10 kids, you have? 10 kids?
10 kids. 10 kids. He doesn't know what to say now.
Well, you definitely need a hybrid van then.
You wouldn't think high gas and oil prices would be a blessing in disguise, but they are. As Victor Lopez found out, they're causing a big jump in the number of jobs.
We turn now to five things you should know about gas, specifically why gas prices, even at over $4 a gallon, can sometimes be a good thing.
And we know that rising gas prices are forcing us to search for alternative fuels and more fuel-efficient cars. There are some other reasons to be optimistic about the high cost of gas. Here are just a few of them.
2,220 people have already been saved over the past year because a reduction in driving has led to less particle pollution in the air. If gas prices stay at $4 a gallon for a year or more, then we can expect that about 1,000 people a month will not die.
Well, Paula, there you have it. Under George Bush, high gas prices, according to the media and our beloved politicians, was destroying the American economy, was destroying lives, and Obama could feel your pain. But once Obama's president, it's a good thing. We're benefiting. There's all kinds of benefits from high gas prices, and Americans are embracing those benefits. And the president doesn't feel your pain. Shoot, you know, if you got a big family and you have to have a big vehicle, too bad for you. Ha, ha, ha. Ha, ha, ha. You got to pay extra money to fill up your big van or whatever. Look, first of all, he said you need a hybrid van. I've looked at hybrid SUVs and hybrid vans. They have worse gas mileage on the highway. Go ahead.
What types of benefits are there? I mean, 3 weeks ago, I drove down to Baltimore, right? And, you know, it's 95 all the way through. I was driving through Connecticut, and I was mortified to see $4.75 a gallon. I almost lost my mind. I said, thank God I filled up in Massachusetts before I left, because I wasn't going to touch anything again until I got through New Jersey.
Absolutely, absolutely. There's no benefit. But this is what they try to change and alter the way we think about things, and they've succeeded based on that poll that I read you. You know, Americans are buying into this that, oh, well, we're actually better off with higher gas prices. But during the Bush year, now, when prices spiked under Bush, he took some measures to bring those prices down. I think he did release some of the strategic reserves, but also allowed some new drilling to go on, et cetera, that then drove down the gas prices. So by the time Obama took office, gas was below $2 a gallon. It was anywhere from about $1.75 to $1.87, depending on where you were in the country. I think the overall average was $1.87, but it was as low as in the $1.70 range, which is pretty darn low when you think about it, the end of 2008. And that's what Obama inherited, low gas prices. What has he done? Well, they've made it a point to make it very clear. He's not in control, and I'm going to get to that. I'm going to get to where the media is a perfect example. Oh, he's not in control. But my prediction is, if gas prices are down in September, although they made this valiant effort to explain to us, it's not, he can't control gas prices. No, he can't do anything about it. He will take credit for something that he's previously told us he doesn't have any control over. This is what this president does. He continually takes credit for things that he has not done, that somebody else has done, or is not under his control whatsoever. But if things go south, oh, not my fault. Oh, yo, go back to Bush. Go back to somebody. Go back to Ben Franklin. Go back to somebody. It's never his fault. Okay, so let's take a listen to Secretary Chu, Secretary of the Energy Department, and what he had to say about gas prices. This is he's presenting the position of the administration. He represents the administration.
Mississippi Republican Congressman Alan Nunnally asked if the Department of Energy is actively trying to lower fuel costs.
But is the overall goal to get our price?
No, the overall goal is to decrease our dependency on oil, to build and strengthen our economy, and to decrease our dependency on oil.
Chu first irritated Republicans when he told the Wall Street Journal in 2008, quote, somehow we have to figure out how to boost the price of gasoline to the levels in Europe. The argument being if Americans are forced to pay $8 or more per gallon, that would help wean the country off fossil fuels.
Okay, so we need to wean ourselves off of fossil fuels. What are we going to replace it with? We don't have anything to replace it with. Why is it, Paula, that we are going to get away from the evil, evil oil, the evil, evil energy source that has propelled this nation and the world into the 21st century? And we have no replacement. We have no replacement. None. Zero. What kind of failed and stupid, idiotic ideology is this? We're going to force ourselves to come up with something. But the question is, Secretary Chu, what is the replacement for gasoline? Well, electric cars. Where are we going to get that electricity? Because we're shutting down coal plants and we're shutting down nuclear plants. We're not building any new nuclear plants. Where are we going to get that electricity? Wind and solar? We use way too much energy in this country to rely on wind and solar. Nothing wrong with wind and solar, but it cannot possibly produce the massive amount of energy that we use via coal, oil, and gasoline. It can't possibly. So we are going to wean ourselves off of something with no replacement in sight. None.
Well, maybe we'll run our vehicles on that algae stuff you were talking about a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, the stuff that doesn't really quite exist. And the only way to mass produce it quickly is to create four times the amount of carbon emissions that producing gasoline and then pumping it out your car produces. So yeah, they're sharp. They're really a sharp group there. They just know what they're doing. This Secretary Chu has never worked in the private sector other than as a professor. He's an academic. He doesn't know the first thing about creating a job, and he threw that in there. Oh, it's the great jobs and economic stability. Well, great. Yeah, that's working really great, Mr. Chu. All these failed little green companies that you've pumped billions of dollars into, and all the jobs have been created. Oh, wait, no, unemployment's up. Yeah, working really good, dumbass. All right, final one I'm going to play is this is the media, the complicit media, telling us that the president can't control gas prices. Now, you've already heard the clip of them blaming Bush. It's all his fault for high gas prices, and he can't. And we looked at the poll that the American people, the majority of American people back then, believed that Bush could control gas prices. Today, almost nobody thinks that the president can. So here's the hypocrisy of the media.
Are they also bringing up the Iran uncertainty, the improving economy, the kinds of things we just heard from John Kilduff?
Sure, they'll bring that up, but of course it's in their interest from a political perspective to talk less about kind of the underlying economic factors that are maybe outside of the president's control and focus more on what they claim the president could do or is not doing to fix the situation. Now, the truth is that, you know, the administration will push back and say, look, you know, we've opened up a lot of areas to drilling, as you're
not true, not true.
Out. And the truth is that the president may not be able to do anything in the short term to head off these prices because they're being driven by forces that are global in nature and not centered here. But the Republicans aren't going to focus on that. They want people to believe and to understand that it's the president at fault.
Oh, it's the president's fault, but it's not really because it's global forces. But when Bush was president, no global forces whatsoever. It's all the president's fault. Hypocrites, liars, deniers, just plain stupid. You know, they don't even listen to their own previous shows. Go back and look at your own commentary 3-4 years ago when you were blaming the president and claiming that it's all his fault. They don't even know what they said 4 years ago. That's how stupid they are. The final one is the president. The president wanted higher gas prices. The key to this little clip, 6 seconds, is that he didn't want it to happen rapidly because it hurts us too much if it happens quickly. But he did want it to happen. So it's not great audio, but
could these higher prices help us?
I think that I would have preferred a gradual adjustment.
So the question from the commentator was, could these higher prices, higher oil prices hurt us, help us? I mean, there you go. There's the media. Yeah, isn't higher food prices and oil prices and house prices, isn't that all going to help us out and make things better? And then the president's response, I'm just throwing those other things in there, so we're just talking about gas, is, well, I would have preferred a more gradual process. I want it to be gradual. I want to stick this knife in the back of the American people slowly, not rapidly. That's basically what he's saying. So there you have it. They've done everything they can to deflect his culpability on gas prices. Ah, he's got nothing to do with it. Not his fault. It's all global forces. This is my prediction. Come October, if gas prices are below $2 a gallon or even close to $2 a gallon, he will take credit for something that he's tried to make very, very clear he has no control over and shouldn't be taking credit for the high prices. Suddenly he'll be taking credit for the low gas prices because he lies repeatedly to the American people and only cares about getting reelected in politics. Now, this is what the libtards always say to me. Oh, Tom, now that's all anybody ever cares about, these politicians. I don't care. Good. Say that about him out there. They're all doing that. He's the president, and that's why I want to boot him out of office. And I don't care if the next guy does the same thing. I just want to get rid of him so at least we don't have to give him the satisfaction of screwing us for another 4 years. All right. So it's time to bring our special guest on, who's going to be here with us on a weekly basis, hopefully, and sometimes it may have to be just a recorded session. We're very fortunate to have Nick Tax here with us live tonight. Nick, how are you doing?
Yeah, what's up? I'm okay.
Good, good. Well, we're pleased to have you. Listen, we've already kind of introed this thing earlier in the show, so we're just going to turn it over to you, and you run with whatever it is you got planned. And then when you're done, we'll chat a little bit about it, and then we'll let you go.
Okay. All right. Cool. I had an enormous amount of coffee about an hour ago to prep myself for this. And I had this enormous bubble of gas brewing at the bottom of my – if I burp like the mother of all burps, you know, over the – air, you could probably chalk it up to the best political commentary out there right now.
Yeah, no, yeah, that probably would be pretty close to Dennis Miller's commentary last night on Riley.
I missed that. I was at a comedy show here in D.C. I missed that one. But
no,
yeah,
Dennis Miller was actually good last night. We can blame it on me,
okay.
Or I'll just say it's my cat.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, this, what I wrote, because the Duh Progressive, DUHProgressive.com, that's my satire site, 90% of it, you know, deals, it's all jokes, it's all satire. There's some true news on the left side, and there is a true commentary section for when I want to ramble off, when something really gets my goat and I want to ramble off about it. There's the true commentary section. And I rambled off about 3 weeks ago. Something got to me in the news. And although, yes, I admit it's 3 weeks old, it's about the Super PAC Character Matters and Joe Ricketts, and he was going to run with an ad attacking Obama, you know, through linking him with his former pastor, you know, Jeremiah Wright. Now, I understand that this story is 3 weeks old, but the fact is that even today, Breitbart has their top story is Obama's affiliation with this new party, the Socialist Party, back in the 90s. I'm sorry, I don't remember the 1990s being so desperate of a time that socialism was. Like, the 1990s were, like, pretty cool times. Like, oh, my God. This lowering unemployment and these, you know, these steady gas prices. Oh, no, it's driving me to socialism. But we know where Obama's coming from with that. Anyway, my commentary is as follows, and it's just taken from, you know, I just springboarded off of the Character Matters story. So it's, are conservatives addicted to losing? I'm almost certain of this. I see it on every day on Facebook and on Twitter. I see these stories about Obama's past affiliations. I'm talking 1980s, 90s stuff flying back and forth when the man has already been president for 4 years. So, and the thing is, Tom, November is for us to win. It's ours. It's right here for the taking. It could be a cakewalk, and it should be a cakewalk. But it won't be, and that's not the fault of Barack Obama. Final confirmation for that of that fact was confirmed for me back in mid-May when the Super PAC Character Matters, you know, decided not to run their Reverend Wright ad about Obama based off of the objections of Mitt Romney himself. But the problem for me was not that Character Matters decided against running the Reverend Wright commercials, and admit, he's Reverend Wright. He's so cute and cuddly and lovable. Uh-huh. You know, he's just like a little teddy bear. Just want to pick up and throw under a steamroller. The problem wasn't that, the commercials were considered. The problem is that they were ever considered at all. This is 2012, folks. It's not 2008. And no, I haven't finished the time machine I'm building in my backyard here yet. We have known about Obama's ties and friendships with radical lefties for over 4 years. And this is what we're still planning on using as fodder for this election. You know, give me a damn break. From Sean Hannity to Mark Levin to Michael Savage to Limbaugh, yes, I'm self-deprecating our sides. That's what we need to do sometimes. And by the way, Limbaugh was talking about this story right as I was writing it, literally, at the 18th of May at 1:13 p.m. right here in D.C., WMAL. To Breitbart, to the Blaze, it seems that the top pundits who allegedly speak for our side think that these are issues that we can win on again. And yes, I said again, because as we remember, they worked oh so well in 2008. And now comes, you know, then came this national story about Character Matters, and then the story about the literary agent who admitted that Obama was born in Kenya in his 1991 bio at the Harvard Law booklet. It was the top story on Drudge all day the Thursday, the 17th, and early Friday, the 18th, and all the rage on the conservative blogs and talk shows. And so what? Were we supposed to, and are we supposed to, embark on another hunt to prove Obama's ineligibility for being president after he's already been president for 4 damn years? I mean, hell, let's even say that Obama admits that he was born in Kenya, okay? Number one, most people do not understand the implications that has. Most people would rack it up to your average voter, that is, would rack it up to a race thing. Most people don't understand that you have to be born on American soil to be president. Okay, number two, most people still wouldn't care even if they did understand. Most who did care wouldn't care to the point that they wouldn't vote for the guy. And, you know, what else would that do except put the wheels in motion in Congress for disqualification that would throw the nation into chaos and cost the Republicans the presidency in Congress for another generation? And I shudder to think of what we will look like in another generation. I mean, my God, the way this one's going, they call this generation Generation Y. I call it Generation Wine. It's the generation under me. I'm 34, and you know, you have the me generation, then the Generation X, so now generation. I think by the year 2022, I think we just might have the totally incontinent generation, just the generation that just they don't get what they want right away. They just literally defecate in their pants. That'll be that generation by then. So with fixations like these on right and the booklet and the person, you know, it's like, have we become addicted to losing? Would we rather have a man in office we can rage about to each other, posting old, pathetically hackneyed stories about and Photoshop Hitler mustaches on rather than actually win elections? Which one is it? Was Obama was born from his mother's Kenyan dwelling womb, Hitler mustache first, or do we actually want to win this damn election? Are we the party the ones that put power back into the hands of the individual, or are we the party of the circle jerk? And for those of you who don't know what a circle jerk is, please don't look it up while you're at work. Unless you're tired of your job and you don't want to have it anymore, then look it up all you want. And no, just because Obama may have participated in some back in the 80s and 90s does not mean it's a viable issue today. You know, ask yourselves, do we want to be the party that opens the doors again for jobs, for success, investment, individual liberty, confidence, and pride, or are we just content to stand around in a circle and perform some abstractly perverse act of self-abuse over the president's past relationships? Yes, it makes for juicy, great, sexy talk radio, but just like in 2008, when the rubber meets the road and voters reach for that lever, most Americans will still not care. Look, guys, I didn't make the rules. I didn't make the rules on what people care about and why they vote, okay? I'm just breaking the sad reality of them to you here. You know, oh, look, Obama lit agent says he was born in Kenya. Oh, look at Obama's preacher. Look at what he wrote in his 1995, you know, Dreams for My Father. Enough. We get it. Over. Done. It's time to zip up our pants, pull our heads out of our asses, turn out from our circle jerk, turn to the rest of America and say, what has this man done for you over the last 4 years? How has your life improved since January 2009? Are you better off? Are you happier? Are you prouder to be an American since Obama took office? Those are the questions we should be asking average Americans, your moderate voters, and your independent voters, because they're who decide the election. And the economy, national debt, joblessness, taxes, Medicare, Social Security, home foreclosure, the gas prices, which you were just mentioning, which just seemed to taper off. But there's still, what, 360? That's something to woo-hoo about? No, it's not. No, we're still standing around our little circle jerk having these politically masturbatory discussions about issues that do not matter to the average voter. It's time to get a grip. So, yes, yanking it to the sounds of Obama's former pastor screaming, "Goddamn America," pardon me, may feel oh so good in the moment. But just like in a drunken binge, we'll wake up on the morning of November 7th, and we'll ask ourselves, what the hell happened last night? Only it won't be about last night. It'll be about an entire year we could have dedicated to discussing real problems Americans have grown and groaned with under this president and how he has done anything but raise America out of this cluster, you know what, that he vowed to fix. So ironically, the only people I hear, Tom, that are actually talking about these real issues that affect – that real voters just actually resonate with are Mitt Romney and this little old Texan guy named Ron Paul that, of course, never says anything that makes sense. So rest assured, if either of these guys win in November, they won't win because of Reverend Wright, Bill Ayers, birth certificates, dreams from my father, you know. And if I were Romney, I would tell Donald Trump and that dead cat he calls hair and his weird fish lips to get the hell away from me with your birth certificate stuff. It's not helping with the average voter. So just like any group of people, the squeaky wheel gets the oil, and that is no different in our case. For most conservatives, these issues take a back seat, and, oh, God, now I brought up the Jim Crow era. Oh, God, sorry, guys. I'm sorry. No, seriously. Now, but no, for most Republicans, conservatives, these issues take a back seat. But for a smaller and far too louder portion of us, Obama's past affiliations and statements before 2008 are like what the La Brea Tar Pits were to woolly mammoths. It's like we're stuck on some past torrid love affair that ended in disaster, breaking out love letters and photos from the good old times, downing a bottle of Sutter Home and, you know, calling friends up at 1 a.m., boo-hooing endlessly about the one that got away. Well, guess what, folks? She got away. She got away in 2008. The train left the station back then, and there's no coming back. And what are we still doing now? I can get on Facebook at any point. I'm friends with 1,300 whatever people. I can go on any, you know, almost any of the Facebook groups I belong to and see a story about Obama's, you know, pre-2008 past, or a picture of him, you know, with a Hitler mustache or next to Stalin or whatever. You know, Jesus, how pathetic. What we have, more substantive issues with which to campaign against Obama. And they're not sex. I'm sorry. They're not sexy. They're not Jeremiah Wright. They're not God, you know, GD America. They're not Obama's alleged dalliances in Chicago's gay bathhouses. They're not former domestic terrorist Bill Ayers. They're not quotes from Dreams of My Father, who, by the way, dumped Barack as a son, leaving him for his grandparents and his mother to raise, something I can certainly relate to. And they're not any of those things. They're not issues wrapped up hypnotically around one man, because we're not just campaigning against one man, folks. We're campaigning against a mindset, a movement, you know, and if we campaign on them, then they're just going to already enhance Obama's existing creepy, you know, cult of personality. And he is creepy, let's admit it. I could totally see him running around Chicago's gay bathhouses, you know, back in the day. And, you know, if I would have run into him, it would have been like, damn, man, I need to find myself another gay bathhouse to hang out at. I'm just kidding. Okay. Get this creepy Barry guy. Don't touch me, Barry. Get away, man. No means no. You know, well, you want to spread my welder? Oh yeah, I bet you do. Yeah, among other, you know. So concentrating on his personal life already like enhances this creepy cult of personality, and it ultimately won't bring us victory in November. Are we still going to cry about the past of a single man, or are we going to stand up, folks, and strive for the future of us all? If it's the latter, then beautiful. Tally-ho, or as they say now, I think forward is the term, yes. If it's the former, then God help us. So that will confirm that basically our side, you know, the squeaky wheel wins the day, and we're more interested not in winning, but talking to each other about all these past issues that are dead issues and are addicted to losing. But then again, another 4 years of Obama, that would sure boost those talk radio ratings, wouldn't it? So that was my commentary for today.
Well,
it's
good.
It's a bit serious, and it's, you know, a little different than what I normally do, but it just really gets to me. I can go on Facebook anytime and find Obama with a Hitler mustache on. How does that help us?
No, it doesn't. I agree with you. Well, first of all, I got a couple comments because you make very, very good points. And number one, liberals, libtards, as I like to call them, they really don't care. He could be a devil worshiper. They only care about the end, which justifies the means. So they don't care about the means. They care about the end. So we're not going to convert any liberals. It's the masses, the uninformed masses. And as you said, I believe they care about three things. Number one, their own life. And as you said, well, are you better off now? Their own life is tougher now. Inflation is up, many, you know, unemployment's up, et cetera. So number one, they care about their own life and what's going on, and it's not better than it used to be. Two, who looks presidential? Thank goodness we got a president that's got hair on his head, and he does look presidential. So he's got to continue to come off as being presidential. And I'll come back in a moment to why Obama's looking less and less presidential. And third, who offers the best platitudes? The masses just gobble up hope and change, the future, we're going to make things better for you, on and on. Who's going to offer up the best platitudes? And I don't want to see Mitt Romney start going down that path, but he can to some degree when he's talking about some substance. He's got to throw some platitudes in there to go along with that substance. Obama's never talked about substance. It's always pure platitudes. That's how he won, I think, for the most part. Well, there are a lot of reasons. You know, we had John McCain running against him, but he offered up all these wonderful platitudes, and people –
people were nervous, people were frustrated, and so the platitude sounded good, but it's a guy that has no experience accomplishing anything. I was saying to my wife earlier today, we've got Mitt Romney, who had an 80% success rate, turning around failed companies, not companies that were going to get ahead without Bain Capital. Without somebody like Bain Capital coming in, their history, gone, sayonara, 80% rate at turning that around. What is this president's turnaround rate for this economy and this nation been? 0%, complete failure. He hasn't turned a single thing around. And why? Because he had no experience prior. How is a community agitator that's never run a business, never saved a company, never created a job, going to suddenly come and turn this country around? So that's what people have to understand, his record. And so as they pound on his record, I agree with you, forget this other minutiae to the side, pound on his record, what do we see happening with this president? He gets angry. He gets frustrated. He doesn't want to talk about his record. We're going to see him become less and less presidential the more we hammer away at his failed record and the corruption within his administration. So that's where Mitt Romney can come out ahead. And finally, people have to understand that if we just focus on getting Obama out of office in the way that you've talked about, Nick, once he's out of office, he won't be carrying that big corrupt stick any longer that he can beat people down with, and all of the truth is going to come out. The rats will have abandoned the ship, and they're all going to start writing books and doing interviews, exposing the true corruption and the lies that we've been getting for the last 3.5 years. So there's where your satisfaction will come. Don't try and get your satisfaction now when this guy controls the wheels, the steering wheel to the ship. Get him off of that ship, and then once he's out of control, the truth will all come out, and then you can have your satisfaction. But the key is to get rid of him right now. Am I on the right track there?
Yeah. I'm not going to read that. I'm not going to say all that and be like, no, let's keep him around. We kind of like old Barry. No, yeah. Yes, exactly. You know, what I was saying is with gas prices, they've tapered off. Okay, I understand that. But, my God, when he took office, I mean, around this area, they were just a little bit above $2. I think nationally they were about $1.80 to $1.90. Now they're $3. And there are certain steps the president can take to reduce that. There are certain things, you know, in some ways it's out of the president's hand. We understand that. It's a global market for that. But that's one thing that everyone can relate to, is my point, is gas. Another thing people can relate to, everyone uses light bulbs. Guess what you can't buy anymore? Yeah, you have to buy these things that are laced with mercury and all that. And, I mean, it's the little things, and like you said, the platitudes. Not all platitudes are bad. I remember back in 2000 when Bush v. Gore, Gore was running around, you know, describing his tax code he was going to have, and how he's going to cut this certain tax and raise taxes on these certain people, and all these little ifs, ands, and buts. And Bush got up there and he was reading Gore's stipulations that his campaign put out on his campaign site, and Bush said, he turned in disgust and he says to the audience, "How many of you pay federal income taxes?" They all raise their hand. And he goes, "Under me, you get a tax cut." Boom.
There
audience
you go.
Loved
yeah.
it. Game over. You're done. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Not platitudes. Exactly. They can be a real, you know, hope, change. You know, that feels good. You know what Mitt Romney should have as his campaign slogan? Puppies. They just feel good. Who doesn't like puppies?
Yeah.
Hope, change, puppies, good things, vacuous statements. You just
yeah.
have a big blank. Fill in this blank with whatever you want. Make it your campaign slogan. I'll win. What's your thing? Oh, I'm into S&M. Okay. Romney, 2012, S&M. Okay, great. I'll vote for you. Just have it a blank. Just have people fill in whatever they want.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, this is where we need to go, and I absolutely agree with you, and that's why we try to I point a few things out here now and then on the show, but we don't try to dwell on this stuff. I don't know if we've ever talked about the Kenya thing on the show. It's just not worth it. There are too many other important issues that people need to understand. that especially the masses need to understand, that the hypocrisy and the lying of not only this administration but the complicit media is don't listen to them. You know, you've got to dig yourself. You've got to take the time yourself to look for the facts and then make a honest, well-informed decision. I'm surprised at how many people that are out of work, people that are struggling, people have a small business struggling, are on the fence about whether to vote for Obama or not. I'm thinking, what are you people, idiots? And the problem is there are a lot of people, probably I would say close to a majority in this country, that are just not well-informed. And I saw this when I was campaigning a few years ago. I'd run into people constantly around this time frame prior to the election, like, I'm tired of the negative ads. I'm tired of, I don't want to talk politics. It just makes me sick. But then when it came time to now have to get out and vote, and they were the good people that want to vote and have a say, they didn't know what the issues were. They didn't know who to vote for. I was getting emails on a daily basis, say, Tom, who should I vote for on this and at this race and that race? And some of the local clubs and groups were just inundated with requests for sample ballot sheets, because they don't want to spend the effort to decide. So it's good. The ads and the debates are going to have to be very carefully crafted to reach the uninformed masses in a way that is not petty and is not focusing on Obama's personal life and past, but rather his record. That's how to reach the uninformed masses, because they will combine, as I said, those three things: their personal life, who looks presidential, and record and substance, yeah, and a few platitudes thrown in there. So that's what they're going to have to target. And I don't think it's going to be hard. I see this president getting angrier and more arrogant at times and not looking presidential. And I love it. Great. Keep it up. Keep going down that road, Mr. Obama. Just keep talking about things that don't matter. Keep trying to focus on issues that have nothing to do with your record, to divert from your record, and you're going to look unpresidential and unqualified.
Well, if you want to point out something personally about him that just happened over the past 2 days, he was at the gay lesbian fundraiser out in California, and he made that joke about his wife doing push-ups with the lady, and Michelle lost, and he something to the effect of, well, then again, Michelle's never does go down completely, and that to me, if I were gay, like he would not have made that off color of a joke unless he was at a gay fundraiser. To me, that's like it's discriminatory. It's pandering to the point of condescending discrimination. It's kind of like when Ross Perot spoke at the, I think it was the NAACP in 1992. Don't ask me for specifics. I was 14 years old, but I do remember he said, you people, all, he just inadvertently said you people.
Yeah.
That's condescending. It's discriminatory. Yeah. But for some reason Obama will get a pass, even though he feels, oh, okay, now I'm at an LGBT event, and I know what I'll do. I'll have my writers write up some oral sex jokes. Yeah, that'll do it. And if I was gay, I'd be like, what the hell? You come here and you think, oh, because you're here, you got to make an oral, By the way,
well, he's making the assumption that gay and lesbians are more promiscuous than the rest of the population. That's really what he's saying, and more tolerant of off-color jokes. I think it was a despicable joke, and it was disgrace. I mean, it should have been considered humiliating to his wife to make a statement like that. I think it's just really poor, poor taste. This just goes to show how unpresidential he's become, but it's his true colors coming out. This is the kind of guy he is.
Yeah. And on another note, such an unflattering thing to admit about your wife, too. I'd rather admit that my wife, like, drowns kittens for fun than admit that. So, on a cultural level, that ain't flying either. So, it was degrading. It was degrading to his wife. It's degrading to the nation to have a commander-in-chief make that color joke. I can get up next week at RFDs and make that color joke. It's a room full of adults that stand up. There's no kids around. That's what it's about. But you're the president of the United States, man. Get a grip.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's there are a couple things along that line that have always bothered me about him. I've seen this kind of behavior from him ever since he was campaigning as a U.S. senator. And I've made it a point on the show numerous times, say I have never seen a candidate or an elected official say the word I or me more than this guy. It's always I, me. He never says us. He never says we. I mean, you know, every now and then. But politicians just don't do that because it doesn't come across as good. And this is the arrogance of him. He's like, well, I'm above all of that. I can be different than everybody else and not try and be inclusive of everybody because everybody's fawning over me and I'm just the greatest thing since sliced bread. So it's always about him. And I find that disgusting. And also having done a career in the military, I see that as extremely poor leadership. I mean, just some of the poorest leadership I've ever seen in my life. And I honestly don't expect him to be a good leader because he's never been in that position before. But the American people elected a guy who has no leadership skills, is totally self-centered, and this is what we get. And he highlights this as this campaign goes on. No record to run on, totally self-centered, and incapable of really appearing very presidential anymore. It just gets worse and worse, and I'm glad. I love seeing this. Become less and less presidential and start looking. You know, there have been some articles written about how, depending on who he's talking about, he wants you to laugh at the fact that he was a cokehead and a pothead, or he wants you to think that he's really tough on national security, or that he really cares about Israel. I mean, it just depends. He wants to appear presidential to one group, religious to another group, cokehead, pothead, and now a porn guy, you know? So I don't... The guy is just a chameleon, which I realize a lot of politicians are that way, but this guy has taken it to an all-new extreme. Pander, 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 do whatever it takes to get reelected, when in fact, it's just making him look that much worse, and I love it. I love it.
Yeah, well, I don't think he's going to lose much love among the gay community, unfortunately. When if you think about it, they're some of the most productive, energetic, wealthy, you know, independently wealthy Americans out there, you know. Why on earth would they be in favor of, you know, paying higher taxes than they already pay?
Yeah.
Why? Because Rick Santorum cares, you know, cares about where they put their pee-pee at night. Nobody cares, you know. I'm not going to vote for that guy. He doesn't like what I do in the bedroom on a personally. He's not going to make any law to stop it. He just doesn't like it. I'm going to vote for this guy who instead is going to rape my wallet, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. And again, it goes back to sort of that liberal ideology, the end justifies the means. We don't care how much you screw us and how much, if in the end we think we've gained some little piece of the pie that we've always wanted to get our fingers on and our hands on, then yeah, we're okay with it versus what's good for the country, what is best for the nation and the future generations. No, they don't really care. They don't care about the destruction they leave behind. If they can stand up one day and go like, look what we achieved, as they look around at the scorched earth all around them. They really don't. They really don't. I've learned that over the years about liberals, that it's always the end justifies the means, even if in the end everything's destroyed except the one little piece of something, ideology that they wanted to achieve. And it's too bad they have to think that way, and we're not going to change them. So my goal is not to change any liberals. My goal is just to reach the uninformed masses and highlight the record, the incompetence and hypocrisy and failing record of this president. As we said at the beginning of the show, Reagan inherited a recession worse than Obama's, and he turned it around in 2 years. Bush inherited a recession, believe it or not. Everybody forgets this stuff, but he inherited a recession, turned it around in a couple years. This president hasn't been able to turn it around. So we have two Republicans that were able to do it and a Democrat that was incapable of doing it and only made it worse. So you can't vote for this guy again. He's absolutely incompetent. So anyways, Nick, hey, it's been a pleasure. I think we'll see you again next Thursday. Is that correct? Same time, same bat channel, 7:30-ish, and have some new commentary or satire or stand-up, whatever it is.
Oh, I'll do something lighter this week. I just had to get this off my chest.
Yeah.
I'll do something lighter, like, you know, make some Holocaust jokes or something. No, I'm just kidding. Honest to God, I can tell you. Can I give you a preview of an article coming up next week? There is a story that is breaking, out, I believe, out of Pennsylvania, where a bisexual man, his wife caught him cheating with another man, and he allegedly he He got so angry at himself for getting caught and for betraying his wife that he beat himself up, and now he's been charged with a hate crime. So, you know, you see how he ferrets his way through that one. So
okay. Well, you know, I'm always curious, and we talked about this when I think we were when we met up in D.C. and I had that layover there and went out to dinner, that how are bisexuals discriminated against? Because they're, you know, they're married, they're like this guy or whatever. How do you discriminate against somebody that can get married? He just, you know, goes out and does other stuff, you know, whatever. But bisexuals are included in the whole discriminatory lesbian, gay, transgender type group, when in fact they're really pretty much like everybody else. They just kind of, you know, go out on the fringe now and then. So I don't know how they're a discriminated group. You know, they're allowed to get married and claim their wife as a spouse for tax purposes and on, but whatever. So, no, that sounds good. All right, Nick. Well, thank
right,
you so
Tom.
Much. Appreciate it. We'll
okay,
see you next
Tom,
week,
Paula.
Thursday night.
All right. Cool. You got it. Goodbye.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
Well, Paula, any comments on, because we had a pretty good discussion, anything you wanted to add to that about concepts of?
To him. I just do. I enjoy listening to Nick.
Well, I tell you what I want to do, and there was a lengthy article in American Thinker that I think a lot of people may have missed. It's the Commodore and the Commerce Clause, and I know we've kind of really gone over heavily the Commerce Clause on this show, but something that a lot of people probably are not aware of, and it's a landmark Supreme Court ruling in 1824 that essentially said the states cannot interfere in interstate commerce. Now, this was the purpose of the Commerce Clause in our Constitution. We needed a referee. Otherwise, the states were going to engage in discriminatory practices, and in fact, they did. It was the Gibbons versus Ogden Supreme Court decision, and it was argued famous lawyer, but won. And here's what was going on. You had states that were creating monopolies. They were saying, we're going to give this company all of the shipping rights in our state or in this harbor or in this waterway, et cetera, and nobody else could participate in commerce. But the problem was this wasn't just state commerce. This was interstate commerce. As people were shipping from, you know, one state to other countries, to other states, et cetera, and shipping was a huge part of our commerce back then. So what the Supreme Court essentially ruled was that the states cannot create monopolies that destroy interstate commerce and that, you know, favor one entity, one company, et cetera. It's Daniel Webster is the one that argued this. But here's the irony of it. What the Obama administration is saying, in essence, is they're attempting to use the Supreme Court judgment overturning state monopoly as the precedent for imposing federal monopoly. Now, how does that add up? You know, it's bad if the states try and monopolize, and let me give you a little, you know, kind of idea about what's going on here. Why would you need a 2,700-page bill, Obamacare, other than to essentially grant monopolies to influential local citizens, thereby causing the free trade of goods and services to be hindered by parochial concerns and regulations? Its intent is for medicine to forever rigidly report to an extensive state bureaucracy instead of the ever-shifting, ever-innovating, unregulated market for new ideas, techniques, and services. That's what the Supreme Court ruled in 1924, was that it stifled interstate commerce to have these state-run monopolies. And yet somehow today it's good to have a federal-run monopoly. So the intent, I mean, think about it. Did our founders write the Commerce Clause, creating a referee to prevent this kind of stuff from the states engaging in this, to then one day have the federal government do the same exact thing? Of course not. It's ludicrous. So if anybody wants to look that up, you know, you can go do a Google of Gibbons versus Ogden. There are probably plenty of articles written about that. Now, one of the individuals that was behind this suit of the states was Cornelius Vanderbilt of the famous Vanderbilt Empire. Now, the libtards will claim that he was a robber baron, when in fact he fought against monopolies and fought for free trade and free market. He wasn't a robber baron of any kind. Robber barons are people that want monopolies and want control and want the government on their side. to squeeze out competition. And he fought that. So he's not a robber baron, as libtards would lead you to believe, and he fought to destroy the state monopolies and free interstate commerce to anybody and all comers. And yet now we have a government trying to go back to those days, except not at the state level, at the federal level, creating monopolies. So I just wanted to bring that up. Again, something you're not going to get from the media. I haven't heard anybody in the media talking about that Supreme Court ruling. And we haven't talked about it because we've talked about a lot of other Supreme Court rulings and other issues. But if you want to find a lengthy article also, go to The American Thinker, and let's see who the author was of this. Go look for Jerome Schmidt. Came out on June 3rd, and it covers the topic very, very well, but it was a very important Supreme Court ruling. And, in fact, many commentators over the years, including, say, John Steele Gordon, said it was one of the 10 moments that made American business, that decision. That decision launched interstate commerce into what we know it is today by crushing those state monopolies. And what are we going to do? We're going to create federal monopolies that will drag us back down and destroy our interstate commerce as far as the healthcare industry goes, whether it be insurance or the healthcare industry itself. So, again, you know, serious topics, important stuff that the media is not going to tell you. And we'll continue this theme as we go forward through the next few months leading up to the election on important issues, things you need to know about that the media, the mainstream media, even some of the conservative media is not going to tell you about, but it's important to know to help you make a decision and to talk to your neighbors about so that they can better understand the importance of this election and where we need to go. And after the election, to hold our representatives accountable. We need to know history. We need to know what the law says. We need to know what's going on. And one more tidbit I'll put out there. Eric Holder has gotten a federal judge to issue an injunction on the state of Florida for purging voter rolls. And it turns out that the clause, the federal law that he's using, doesn't apply in any way. For example, it says that if you are going to make changes to the voting process, that you have to first get approval from the federal government. How does purging voter rolls of dead people and illegal immigrants change voting rules? It doesn't change anything. It has absolutely nothing to do with purging. And we found in Florida close to 180,000 instances of dead people still on the voter rolls and non-citizens on the voter rolls. But Eric Holder would tell us that, oh, no, you know, there's no voter fraud. 178,000? Goodness gracious. And, of course, I know that the Celtics are going to be firing up here. Who are they playing?
The Heat.
The Heat. Oh, yeah, the Heat. Well, the Heat are going to crush them tonight. I'm sorry to say that, Paul. But, you know, not, yeah. Doesn't happen often.
Hey.
Yeah, now, if I were still living up in New Hampshire, I'd be cheering for the Celtics. But Miami Heat, yeah, they've, you know, I haven't given up on them, and I hope they do well. But, you know, it is what it is. So, in any case, we'll wrap up now. Turn it over to you, Paula, for your tribute to our troops.
We're continuing our series, Honoring the Fallen, where the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq have claimed the lives of more than 450 Americans this year, bringing the U.S. death toll to more than 6,300 since 2001. Joe Lee Cunningham, 27. Sean Russell Cutsforth, 22. Devin James Daniels, 22. Nicholas Allen Daniels, 25. And James Michael Darrow, 38. The most recent individual lost their life on June the 2nd, 2012, serving during Operation Enduring Freedom, Army Specialist Gerardo Campos from Miami, Florida. He was assigned to the 4th Battalion, 23rd Infantry Regiment, 2nd Striker Brigade, Combat Team, 2nd Infantry Division, Joint Base Lewis-McChord, Washington. Died June the 2nd in Maywand, Afghanistan, of wounds caused by enemy small arms fire. To the loved ones that are serving overseas, specifically in the Marine Corps, shout out to Lance Corporal Jonathan Ferreira, son of Don Alto Stukos of Fall River, Mass. Your mom, she loves and misses you dearly. To the group that he's serving with, your families love and miss you dearly. God bless, protect, and comfort their families until you all come home. We love and miss you all dearly, and we keep you in our hearts and in our prayers and in our minds every night, and we want you home real soon.
All right, Paula. Well, thanks as always. We'll be back next Thursday. We don't have a special guest right now scheduled for Thursday, but we'll continue on the same thing. And, of course, we will have Nick back doing his next segment at the bottom of the hour. And for all you Celtics fans out there, good luck. You're going to need it. Thank you.
Go, Steve!
Thank you for listening. Well, thank you for listening tonight. And, you know, the Heat has to win tonight. Otherwise, you know, isn't the series over? And we got to – they got to make more money, you know. This is all about making money.
So,
you know, it'll go another round here. But any case, I want to thank everybody. Everybody have a great rest of the week and great weekend, and we'll see you next Thursday. Have a great night, Paula.
Bye.
Listening to the American Hour with Commander Tom Garcia on the USA Talk Radio Network.